you want to be in a position. You just said you know of people or heard of people who have paid cash and made a good deal. You want to be in a position when you find a house is for sale, and almost every house I buy does not have a for sale sign in the front yard. You know, if it has a for sale sign in the front yard, especially in today's market, you're going to have competition. So you need to find the ones that don't have a for sale sign in the front yard. There are people that are sitting on empty houses right now that would like to get rid of them that don't have a for sale sign in the front yard, who are not as concerned about how much they get as just getting rid of the house. And some of them have not been making payments because of the foreclosure moratorium. Some of them are, you know, behind on their payments, and they know the end is near because this won't go forever. And once you find that house, then I tell my broker friends here in town, I said, I know the market's hot, but if you need somebody, if you have somebody that needs to sell and close in a week or less, call me. A week or less, because I can buy a house and close on it in a week or less.
You're listening to the Engineer of Finance podcast with Ken Green. Please stay tuned to the end of the episode to hear boring yet important disclosures. Thank you.
Hi, this is Ken Green, the host of the Engineer of Finance podcast, and I have, as usual, my awesome co-host, Tammy B, here with me.
Hey, Ken.
And I have a special guest. He's been on the show before, and I can't remember what episode, but I'll find out before the show ends. But I have John Schaub. I refer to him as the real estate guru, but he's written Building Wealth One House at a Time, which is a best-selling book. He's helped out numerous families over the last, at least 30 years, John, right? Helping with
We're pushing 50 now.
Oh, 50 years. So almost 5 decades. And so he has an incredible amount of experience in real estate. And I'm so happy to have him on. Thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, my pleasure. My pleasure.
So there's been a lot has happened over the last year since this pandemic. And I would argue, more importantly, our government's response to the pandemic. And, you see a lot of the stuff in the news, and I would argue sometimes there's a lot of fear mongering that's going on and instills fear, and fears gets you to listen to the news. And with the real estate side, me personally, with the clients I represent and the relationships I have, it really, these moratoriums haven't had too much of an impact. And I thought it'd be great with all the people you help in real estate, it'd be great to see your perspective. I mean, you're in Florida. That's been a very popular state over the last year for people to move to.
Yes.
To leave the chaos and almost have their freedoms back again. But I was just curious, we can just, very impromptu conversation, but I loved all the listeners to hear what you've experienced and seen for you and the families you help. And you do a lot of workshops and seminars. We're going to talk about that a little bit as well today, if that sounds good for you. But can you explain what you've seen in the real estate side since this pandemic has kicked in, and kind of what you've seen, and maybe not that's fair, but to put you in the spot like a crystal ball, but what you think might occur over the next year? That's fair.
Sure. Well, it's interesting. I've got a group of students that we get together about once a year, and we do it out in Snowmass, Colorado. We go skiing. And last February, we were out there, and that, if you can wind the clock back, that was right before the pandemic started making a lot of news in the United States. So we sat around a room and we asked, everybody gave their 2 cents worth of what they thought the next year was going to bring. And several people said, well, there's going to be change. We don't know what it is. You know, nobody said pandemic, because we didn't know about it much yet. It was just barely getting going. So nobody really anticipated this year. I didn't. who would have known that we would have a real estate market that's as hot as they get, and with high unemployment and with people worried. It's been a year that nobody predicted. So it's pretty hard to predict next year again. But the result in our town, and I've talked to students all across the country, it's been very similar. And that is, most attendants have stayed. We only had, out of all of our tenants, we only had 2 people leave. And one was they cut his hours in half, so he had to go back and live at home. And the other one, there was a death in the family. So they didn't leave because of the market. They left because of personal reasons. And that's kind of normal. And that's a very small percentage. But everybody else stayed. Everybody paid their rent. And as you pointed out, my tenants and I have a pretty good relationship. We really work on, first of all, renting to people that have the qualities that I admire. You know, like they're hardworking. They pay their rent on time. They've got good credit. They want to live in a house for a while. In fact, one of the first questions I ask them is, how long do you want to live in a house? And if they say 6 months or a year, they don't get to the top of the list. You know, I'm looking for somebody who wants to live there for a lot longer than that. Because as a landlord, I know they have to stay 2 or 3 years before I start making any money. If they move out in 1 year, it costs me money. So, you know, I'm looking for somebody that has at least the 3 year potential. And a lot of people stay much longer than that. You know, I have tenants with me as long as 30 years right now, and several 20 year tenants, and a whole bunch of 10 year tenants. So if you can keep people in your houses that long, and the house business is different. People who are new at this are probably scratching their heads right now and said, you know, that doesn't make sense. But it does if you're going to keep a property for a long period of time. You know, if you can, I bought one house that was brand new and the people stayed there 25 years. You know, I never made a payment on that house for 25 years. They made every payment. It had a 20 year loan on it. So they paid it off and they stayed there 5 years after that. And I raised the rent every year. They were happy because the rent raises were fair, and they're always a little bit below the market, and they love the house. They love the neighborhood, and it was their house. And if you think about why people rent, you know, a lot of people rent, you know, about 40% of the people do rent a house, 60% own it, round figures, you know. You know, a lot of them don't want the responsibility. And most of my tenants, I think, are happy with me taking responsibility for roofs and water heaters and air conditioners and all the other things that go along with the house. And as long as I can give them fair rent that they can afford, they will stay a very long time. So I got a little off on a tangent there, but people stayed. And the good news is people stayed. And this is the same story I've heard from all over the country. All of my students, I haven't had a single student report tenants asking for moratoriums on rent or, you know, tenants not paying rent because I think they've all done it the same way. You know, they have houses that people like. They take care of their tenants. They don't overcharge them. And if you do that, you know, people want to stay in your houses. They don't want to cause trouble.
Well, attending your workshops and also now everything's gone Zoom. You know, everything's online now because of COVID. But watching your workshops in person and then virtually and reading your newsletter, I really enjoy your process. I mean, it's a very patient process. This is delayed gratification, building wealth one house at a time. I mean, you're not into flipping homes. You're not into multifamily anymore. You learned from that. You know, you talk about that in your book, the joys of having an apartment complex, maybe not so fun. And but you build relationships. You're very selective. It looks like through you teach what you've done. You're not working off of theory. You're teaching on proven concepts. You build great relationships with your tenants, and it would make sense. And I think you just mentioned charging a fair market value. You're not the most expensive in the neighborhood, are you?
No. The most expensive are generally these hedge funds. The guys that come in and buy a bunch of houses, and they have some mathematical formula they use to determine what the rent's supposed to be, and they try to get that. And you can get that for a little while, but the mistake they're making is if they have turnover, and they're not smart enough to know this yet, but if they have turnover every year or even every 2 years, it's costing them money to rent that house. So if they had a longer term perspective, and I don't believe they do, I think most of these big buyers have a relatively short term perspective where they're going to hold the property until it goes up 30 or 40% or whatever, and then they're going to sell it because they're in the commission business. So they get paid to turn money over, to churn money more than they do just sit and watch it grow over 20 years. So we have a different perspective as long term investors.
Hey, Tammy, you can looking to see when what episode number was for on the Engineer of Finance.
I nice already did that. I read your mind. It's episode 85.
Okay, episode 85. And where are we at now? My gosh, it's like, it's been a while, John, since you've been on. And people who are new to the show or new to hearing about you, John, I mean, yeah, you're not into flipping homes. And it would be nice just to kind of recap why, because I thought that was great. And I remember that episode, Tammy, that was something you were considering it doing at the time.
Yeah. I love
John,
your perspective.
You talked her out of it. You talked her out of it.
Yeah. Because of your long-term thinking. I love your perspective. It was September 19th of 2019 when you guys met last.
Well, that's been a while, hasn't it?
It's been a while.
I learned like all of us have learned, you know, I wasn't born this way. I rode around with a friend of mine one time and he showed me all the properties he used to own. I said, why didn't you keep them? And he didn't have a good answer for that. And then I started studying people that had a lot of money and they bought property and didn't sell it. They held on to quality properties and just kept them forever. And so I developed this long-term perspective because I learned that the folks who amassed quite a bit of wealth over time were not people buying and selling. They were people that were buying quality properties and holding them. because they knew the math. And if you just study the math, you know, if you buy something with a long-term fixed rate loan and hold on to it for 20 or 30 years, it is really hard not to make a lot of money off of that property. Between inflation and just demand and supply, if you live in an area that's growing, rents will go up, prices will go up, and your debt goes down. So you end up with a free and clear house. You paid $200 for it today. If it doesn't go off a dime, it's still worth $220 years. You'll have $200,000 in net worth in that house. And most places, you hold a house 20 years, it will go up.
Well, in that previous episode, I like to pride myself on being a fast learner. Unfortunately, I move very slow. And in that first time you came on the show, I was making fun of myself that it just seems like the homes are way too high. I don't want to spend the money, and I'm terrified to have tenants, so I haven't pulled the trigger yet. And he's like, well, you think they're expensive now, wait till years down the road. It's like, my gosh, boy, were you right. the Reno area, Midtown, all of Northern Nevada, and I'm sure Southern Nevada as well, but the Reno, Northern Nevada area, I mean, the housing is just ridiculous. We have less than 2 weeks of inventory. And yep. And the governor of California, I think it's a great joke, but he got Nevada Realtor of the Year Award. He got Texas Realtor of the Year Award, Idaho, yep. Washington, yep. Utah. So he got a lot of awards for, Realtor of the Year. And that's your sweet spot is, and then you mentioned also the internal rates for return. If people manage and buy building wealth one house at a time, and they go in and acquire a property, single family residence, I assume you prefer over duplexes and over fourplexes.
I do.
Because it's a different type of tenant, different type of relationship.
And one other important point, when you go to sell them, it's a different buyer. You know, I like to sell the single family home buyers who can get a 97% loan down at the bank and sell them a good market like today. I've sold 4 houses last year because you get a retail price and you get all cash. You know, if you sold an apartment building in this market, if you sold to somebody who had enough cash, you could sell it all cash. But if you sell a small apartment building, 5-10 units, generally, that's going to be a mom and pop buyer who needs to go down to the bank and get a loan, and they'll only loan 70 or 80% against that building. So you normally don't get all cash.
Well, yeah, you got a lot less people looking to buy too, right? I mean, we're single family. It's a lot bigger market. Now, it's interesting. This will be an interesting tangent. You sold 4 homes this year. Can you explain why?
No, not this year, last year.
Oh, last year.
this year just got started. And actually, we sold one and closed this year, but we just bought a house. We got a house on the contract right now. So the ones we sold, I've been doing this for a long time. So we're thinning out our portfolio. And, we still have a lot of houses. I don't want people to think I'm bailing out. We sold less than 10% of our portfolio. So we still have a lot of houses. And we're going to hold the rest of them. Nothing else is for sale right now. No, they're going up 10 or 15% a year. Why would you sell an asset that goes up that much and plus gives you some cash flow? I can't find an investment that compares with that. And that's why we have a lot of competition in the house business right now is, the big money is coming in and saying, look, we can get a yield on a cash flow yield, plus we're getting some appreciation. And that's what's driving prices up probably higher than they should be. I think at some point the market will stop and we'll be overbought. There'll be too many people paid a really high price for houses.
Now, did you 1031 those into taking 4 and just managing less properties? So you're going down to 4 to 2, upgrading the type of house. Yeah. So it's more in rent, just to simplify
things. That's been our strategy for the last 20, 25 years, really, is to take, we have a larger portfolio and we've reduced the size of it we have fewer than half as many properties now. But we still have the same amount of money in the market. So what we've done is we've traded to keep it simple, two $200,000 houses for one $400,000 house. But actually, when you do a 1031 exchange, you should be trading two $200,000 houses for a $500,000 house and make $100,000 profit. But to do that, you have to go to work. You have to find that $500,000 house that you can buy for $400,000 before you sell the other two. So it's not just a mathematical exercise.
Well, it's a timing exercise and fingers crossed exercise, I would assume, too.
And yeah, quite a bit of work. So it's not something you do every day. It's something you do, strategically.
Do identify backup properties in case that first one doesn't go through?
No, I get the first one under contract and do a title search and make sure it's a done deal. I don't worry about financing because I'm a cash buyer when I do a 1031, but gotcha. I want to make sure everything else is solid.
Hey, Tammy, you enjoy renting. You mentioned that earlier, John, about the responsibility. I always joke with my wife, maybe not so much joking. Boy, do I miss renting. I've owned, I've rented, I own, but the primary residence, and I would agree with Robert Kiyosaki, I think he's a little extreme, but he'll argue your primary home is not an investment because it doesn't cash flow, which is true. It does cash flow. It's just it's negative cash flow. But they can be a liability on a primary residence, but I still enjoy a property. It's nice seeing the equity go up. So I kind of see it as a hybrid, but boy, do I miss renting. It just sucks you in. It's like, I don't want to fix the roof. I just rather have the landlord do it for me.
I think I had Robert, he wasn't in my class when I was giving the speeches in the audience years ago. And I wasn't really kidding. I was telling people in the audience, you shouldn't buy the house you live in. You should rent it until you acquire enough money to pay cash and buy that house for cash. And then you should steal it. You know, you should make a good deal. We've owned a house we live in since the early 80s. We moved in 1980. We bought it in 82. And we pay cash for it. And it's been free and clear ever since. So if you own your house free and clear, you're still right. It's still negative cash flow. Taxes, insurance, and maintenance is all negative cash flow. So as I'm always kidding the class, the house you live in is a great investment for your kids.
I would agree with that. So your first single family, you bought rental properties first for cash flow before you went out and bought your...
I rented a house we lived in for 10 years, or actually a little more than 10 years before we bought a house to live in. During that time, we acquired a lot of properties, all kinds of properties, but we buy them for cash flow. And my game plan was to be able to pay cash for the house we lived in, and it worked out.
Yeah. And the rationale behind paying cash for your home instead of financing that, was that just because you wanted more certainty, more peace of mind? What was the rationale behind just owning your primary home outright?
Well, if you're thinking about the big picture, let's just say you have a $5 million portfolio, and on that portfolio, you have $3 million worth of debt. So you have $2 million worth of equity. You can spread that debt equally over all that equity, but now you have all that equity at risk, you know, because every time you have any kind of loan on a house, it still has some risk factor. Or you can choose to have some of those properties paid for. I've chosen to have some of those properties paid for and then have my debt just on a few properties. And the house that I live in, I always want paid for. If everything else disappeared, I still get to live there almost for free, right? Pay taxes and insurance. Not anticipating that. I don't think that would ever happen, but the house you live in does make you feel better, make your spouse feel better. You know, having a free, if you're an investor and you don't have any kind of cash flow from a salary, you know, it's nice to be able to live someplace where you know your overhead's low.
Yeah, so safety factor. I mean, it's a smart decision. I would argue an emotional decision too, mm-hmm. but I think a great way to play it. And I shopped that idea years ago to my wife about, hey, let's just rent and then go buy rental properties. There's an emotion piece there, I think, with a lot of families. And now, Tammy, do you want to chime in? I have a few other questions for John for today.
Well, I just am totally in support of what you were saying, both of you, about the not only the emotional factor of owning something, but then on the opposite side, the bounceability I feel in renting, like it just gives me flexibility, and I love that, and I don't like the responsibility. So I can see both sides of what you two are saying.
And then you like the fruit. Now, the place you've been renting, do you live apartment, multifamily, single family?
It's apartment.
Apartment. And mm-hmm. you've been there for pretty stationary.
Going on 5 years.
Oh, great. That's good. I do like the freedom of renting. Now, I can say, if you see the rent in our markets today in Reno, John, it's unreal. So about 6 months ago, just trying to find properties, I was suggesting to my wife, maybe we go rent a place and then go rent out our current home. And that didn't go over too well, but mostly not necessarily because I personally hate moving, but rent's just ridiculous. I mean, our mortgage, you know, we didn't buy our home cash. I like the idea of doing as little as down, but I also admire your approach. You just say, we're going to make the passive income, the cash flow, and then you negotiate a great deal. It's amazing when you come in with cash, you can negotiate a great deal. I've seen clients do it over and over again, even in seller's market over the last few years. There's typically there will be an opportunity that will seek you out that if you can close within 2 weeks, because there's an immediate need for that family, you can offer well below market rates. For example, I'll talk about my question. I thought real estate was ridiculous a year and a half ago. So what do I do now? Although none of us have a crystal ball. And if we do, it doesn't work. I mean, there's nothing out there. I mean, the average, it's over 10 people at least are bidding on homes. And then you get the egos involved, you get the competition. And some of these situations I've seen locally over the last few months, it's just people are getting silly. I mean, they just keep going on top over each other. To close, to get the home, to win. And so if people who want to take kind of your approach, now I'm going to encourage anyone who's new to hearing John, at the very least, go out and get his book, Building Wealth House, One House at a Time. It's just a very simple, it's very educational. It's just a very, it all makes sense, right? It's very logical, but it takes someone from the outside to explain things. What would be a way someone wants to take an approach, and you really believe in working it in your backyard? I don't believe you're a fan of buying, well, I'll let you talk about it, but what do I do? I mean, what do listeners do that want to buy a house? Should they do these turnkey?
I'll give you a couple points. Please. First of all, I've owned property in 10 states and I'll never do that again. You lose too much control, way too much conversation with managers. I mean, things just don't go nearly as well as you think they're going to go. And you talk to anybody who's owned property far away, they're going to have that same story eventually. Maybe they just bought it and they're happy, but give me a few years and come back and talk to me a few years from now. Tell me you're still happy. So owning property as close to you as possible is a good idea. Draw a circle on a map, and a pretty small circle, in an area that you want to buy. And so, you know, maybe 20 square blocks or 10 square blocks, and identify where you want to buy. Because you want to be in a position. You just said you know of people, have heard of people who have paid cash and made a good deal. You want to be in a position when you find a house is for sale. And almost every house I buy does not have a for sale sign in the front yard. You know, if it has a for sale sign in the front yard, especially in today's market, you're going to have competition. So you need to find the ones that don't have a for sale sign in the front yard. There are people that are sitting on empty houses right now that would like to get rid of them, that don't have a for sale sign in the front yard, who are not as concerned about how much they get as just getting rid of the house. And some of them have not been making payments because of the foreclosure moratorium. Some of them are, you know, behind on their payments, and they know the end is near because this won't go forever. And once you find that house, then, I tell my broker friends here in town, I said, I know the market's hot, but if you need somebody, if you have somebody that needs to sell and close in a week or less, call me a week or less, because I can buy a house and close on it in a week or less. Okay, I can either write the check or borrow the money from a friend and write the check or put together some kind of owner financing deal. But I can get it closed in a week or less. Most people can't do that. So if you develop a skill set, which means you have knowledge of values, you have access to either some money or credit or an investor or something, so you can actually get the house closed in a week or less, then you're a rare buyer. I mean, most people who buy houses still go to the bank and borrow the money. Now, the flip side of this is, and I just wrote a newsletter on this, you've probably read it, is that you can go out and pay retail for a house today, go down to the bank and get a retail loan and still make a profit. I mean, you can still rent it for more than your payments because interest rates are so low. Now, if you pay $400,000 for a house that's worth $350,000, but you get a 3.5% loan for 30 years, that's still a good deal because the interest rates are so darn cheap. And you can probably rent that house for more than your payments. And I know that's for a fact because three or four houses I sold were bought by investors who went down to the banks and got loans. And every one of them has cash flow on those houses. It's doable today. But in order to actually buy one, you have to be focused. I mean, you have to know where you want to buy, kind of what you want to buy, and then be ready to pull the trigger. So when you find somebody who says, you know, we've got to leave town next week, you can pull the trigger and say, I'll buy your house and we'll close next week.
How do you go through the process again? Obviously, if you're closing within a week, I mean, you've built an impressive team around you. I mean, do you have an inspector that you can call up? Like, how do you know? Well, to close on a week, I mean, there's due diligence. I mean, title company.
Well, if you're closing without getting a new loan, it goes a lot faster. You can see that, right?
Oh, sure.
I can go to a lawyer in this town that I don't even know or a title company I don't know and say, I need to close this week. I'll pay you twice your normal fee and they'll do it. Right? So if I'm buying a house below the market or I'm buying a house with great financing, instead of paying them $2,000, I pay them $4,000. That's good enough. And you really don't have to do that. Most of the time, you can pay a little bit more, or you can just beg and get it done. And if you've done business over and over again with the same people, they'll take care of you. So, but if you're brand new at it, don't be afraid to pay a little bit extra to get it done faster. Because, you know, I like to tell the story. I went to Vegas one time with my friend Jack Miller, and I was always in charge of getting the books printed and bringing the books with us. So I got out there, and we had 180 people in the class. And I had miscounted. I only had 90 books. So, and I didn't discover this until 7:30 in the morning in the class, which started at 9. I went out and got 90 books printed in an hour and a half.
Wow. That's impressive.
Yeah, because I found some guy and said, if you'll stop what you're doing right now and print these books and bind them so I can take them back to this place in an hour and a half, I'll pay you a lot of money. And they did.
Yeah, I always joke, more money, not when it's going to the government, but more money can solve more problems. And so that's a perfect example.
Yeah, don't tell the government that, will you?
Now, when it comes to, like, but do you have, like, an inspector? Or what do you go through on something like that? You just know what to look for? Or do you actually have someone on your team that can walk through and inspect the house as well?
Sure. I know inspectors, and you know inspectors. I mean, everybody knows inspectors. If you call one up and say, look, I know you're busy, I've got to get this thing inspected in the next 2 or 3 days, I'll pay you twice as much, you think they'll do it?
I would argue, yes, I would say most agreed. They will.
They would do it. They would work nights and get that done. I mean, they put an extra 2 hours in and get it done. So you can get it done. We're just talking about how much now. But, you know, if you don't make a good deal, maybe you don't want to go to that expense. I buy simple houses, Ken. I don't buy fancy, complicated houses. So I can look at a house pretty darn quickly all by myself. I'm no mechanic, but, you know, I can tell if it's been well maintained. I can tell if it's fairly well built. I can tell if it's fairly well designed. And if it's a junker, I'm not going to buy it, you know. But if it's something that has good bones and looks like it's pretty good shape, then, you know, if I'm nervous about the electrical or termites or the roof, I can call one of those people and get them out there pretty fast and have them check it out. But I'm willing to take a house as is. And I buy almost all my houses in as is condition. And, you know, every once in a while that costs you some money, but 9 out of 10 times the house is in pretty good shape. And you can see enough about it because, you know, you've heard me talk before, but my focus really is on the land more than the house. I'm looking for a really good lot and a good subdivision. But I'm not buying a fancy house. You know, I'm not buying a 4,000 square foot house with two air conditioners. I'm buying a 1,300 or 1,400 square foot house with one air conditioner and simple plumbing and simple kitchens. And so you can tell pretty fast if it's in good shape.
Identifying the location, like what's a good piece of property, school system, is that a big one?
Well, you look at neighborhoods that are hot. I mean, where people want to live. And the easiest way to spot those is you drive around, you find neighborhoods where people are remodeling houses, keeping the old houses, fixing them up, or tearing the old houses down, building new ones. You know, people that value those lots, and then you research what they're paying for those houses that are tearing down. You know, I last night I was on the, and I get my information off the public records. You know, I don't go to Zillow or anyplace else. I get it off the public records. But I'll look up and see what people paid for a house in my neighborhoods when they buy them. And so I know what the houses are worth. And when they tear a house down, and they paid $500,000 for a house, and they tear the house down, then I know the lot's worth $500,000.
I can tell you one of my major temptations over the last 6 months, and it's just cause probably I'm being frugal, and I don't want to work too hard, maybe, and I'm fearful it'll bite me in the butt because, you know, I've watched what you teach, I've watched it through clients, been mentored by you for decades. There is a huge temptation for me to get into triple net type situations on the commercial space. There's a huge temptation for me to do some of these turnkey programs that I'll see. Like, I mean, my gosh, good luck finding a house in the Reno area for $400,000 where I could go do some turnkey thing in Cleveland, Ohio, and buy the same property with a similar rent for $125,000.
No, you go to Cleveland, you won't buy the same property. The numbers may look different to you, but it's not, the house is not in Reno, it's in Cleveland.
It's in Cleveland.
You can buy a house in Cleveland for $10, and then they'll sell, turn around and sell it to you for $30,000. I mean, houses were free in some of those areas. Yeah. So you have to be very careful when you go out of town, unless you've been there and you know the street, you've seen the house, you know the neighborhood, don't buy that house.
Yeah, it's very tempting because the way you'll see these things advertised on the websites, it's like, hey, we've got a tenant in there. Here's your down. We already got property managers laid out for you. And my experience has been here locally, and it's not to be mean to the property managers, there's about 5% I would argue are very good, and I would argue the other 95% make it really expensive.
So what are your odds of finding a good property manager in Cleveland then? If there's 5% are good and 95% are bad, what are your odds?
Well, I'm asking, I mean, you have a lot more experience on that than me, and I have a feeling that might, in this area, might relate to other areas. And so am I missing something?
Yeah, here, let me just write this down. Don't do it.
Don't do it. And the reason why is because property managers can be expensive. Is that why?
Well, you could be paying too much for the house. You could be buying a house that you can't sell to somebody else because it's in the wrong neighborhood. Or you could be buying a house that just has all sorts of maintenance issues. I've had phone call after phone call where somebody bought a house that they hadn't seen out of town. And after they bought it, they found out it needed a lot of work. You know, it needed a furnace, it needed a roof, it needed new windows. It had it was tagged by the code enforcement guys. It's just crazy to do that. It really is. Buy something you've seen, and I'd rather see you pay $100,000 too much in Reno and hold it for 20 years than to go to Cleveland and buy something 30% below the market. Because come back in 30 years, which one do you think is going to be worth more?
I don't know, but even more,
just take
I
a
don't
guess.
Know. I don't know.
Cleveland or Reno? Take a guess.
I've been so wrong on my predictions the last year. I thought real estate was going to tank. I thought I was going to get great deals on RVs and motorhomes. And I thought people would be afraid and save money. And it's just been ridiculous. I've never envisioned that they'd be printing trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars. It's fascinating to me. Yeah. What our politicians and the central banks are doing. It's crazy. But I know it's hard to have a crystal ball. One thing, I was reading an article a couple of weeks ago. I don't know if it was put out by Wall Street or who wrote the article, but they're saying that default rates right now, the moratorium will be ending. We don't know exactly when, but they're arguing it's as strong as it was in the late 70s, the foreclosure rate. Or not the foreclosure rate, but defaults.
And so defaults are high, but we have a government that may just not forgive them, but may push them off indefinitely, or make the lenders eat some of those loans and add the payments to the back end. So it's not going to be a situation where people are going to lose a lot of houses. I don't think there'll be some, but I think that the people who will work to keep their house will probably have a way to do that. I think there will be a lot of pressure on these lenders not to foreclose, but to add the payments to the end of the loan and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I that's an interesting perspective, and I seeing how much responsibility the government has taken over. I don't know if responsibility is the right word. So this might not be a windfall of opportunity in the next 6 months.
Well, they just, you know, they can change the rules, and they have. You know, they've changed a lot of the rules. Moratorium on foreclosures and evictions, that's a big deal. So if they just, you know, they can rewrite how you get to foreclose, or what the defense against foreclosure will be. So I'm anticipating a change, Ken. Things don't go straight up forever. The market is overheated. People are paying too much. Builders are making too much profit. I think one of the things that will cause a change is I think interest rates will continue to go up. If we have inflation, interest rates won't stay at these rates. So when interest rates go up, that's going to eliminate some of the buyers, and that'll slow the market down some.
This may be a question that you were planning on asking, Ken, so I apologize if I'm stepping on your toes.
Yeah, stepping on my toes.
Okay. John, I have always been really impressed with how much you're willing to share your information, share your knowledge, the wisdom that you've gained over these years of being in the real estate industry. And I'm curious with, you know, the restrictions on people getting together and all that, how are you finding your that part of your business shifting for you? Where, because I know you were doing in-person workshops and so forth. So what are you seeing, or what are you doing over the next, for the last year and over the next couple of months to deal with those restrictions?
Well, you know, you may not know this, Tammy, but I've been teaching two or three classes a year since 1982.
When
we started the family, I made a commitment not to travel. So you know, I never have taught more than two or three live classes a year. So that's, you know, that's a couple of weeks a year is all I've ever dedicated to this side of the business. Now, I do write. I write my newsletter. I like to write books. It makes you think, you know, it's better. You know, you're supposed to do crossword puzzles when you get old. I'd rather write books and newsletters.
I love it.
It's a little different mind game. Plus, I'm in contact with hundreds and hundreds of people all the time. You know, I have students who are good friends all over the country. I know you know some of them. So that keeps me in the business, and I like the business, you know, and I'm still good at it. So I'm going to keep doing this. One thing I knew about this business years ago is that, you know, they can't fire you. So if I'm going to do this for 10 more years, I can do this for 10 more years, or I can quit today. It's my choice.
Yeah.
But I kid that I retire one day at a time. You know, if I want to take the day off, I can take the day off. It's no big deal. It doesn't take many hours to do what I do. And I do take big blocks of time off. And what we miss most is traveling. You know, we Valerie and I love to travel. We travel a whole bunch. We were in Argentina last year in January. We were in Antarctica last year in January. And we would be someplace else right now probably if it wasn't for the moratorium on traveling. So we will travel more. But as far as the seminar business, Zooming has been a wonderful thing for me. You know, it's kind of fun to sit at my desk here and talk to a whole bunch of people rather than get on a plane and go someplace.
Sure.
I've been to St. Louis, and I love St. Louis, but I'm not going back to St. Louis anytime soon, and nor Cleveland or a lot of other places. You know, it's just so much easier to do it from here. But I'll get back out to California at some point because I love California. I have a lot of friends there, a lot of relatives out there. So we'll see some of the West Coast crowd eventually. And right now, the only live thing that I've committed to do, and may change my mind, but there's a group that's going to get together in Vegas in November that we're planning right now, and we'll see if that works out. I kind of hope it does, because I do like to get together with people. It's a lot of fun, you know, to put some people in a room and have live bodies out there and live questions to get a little different feedback. But Zooming has helped a lot because, you know, there's so many people who can't travel or don't want to travel, who need information. So this has been a wonderful thing.
Well, you have, and we'll put in the show notes for this episode, you have a training coming up via Zoom in the next couple weeks, correct, John?
Yeah. Peter Fortunato and I are doing something. I think it's April 24th. It's a full-day class, and it'll start at 11 o'clock in the morning on my time. So that's 8 o'clock your time. I think that's right. Yeah, 8 o'clock your time, and go for 6 hours. And then we'll do questions and answers at the end. So it's an opportunity for you to get some really good information at a very low price and ask questions. So, you know, it'll be a live show, so you get to ask questions.
Well, I know we got to wrap up in a few minutes. I had something just in my risk mitigation. Like, I mean, my brain has been stewing, and so I fear I love exposing all my weaknesses and ignorance so people can learn on the show. I mean, I asked this last time, how do you just get over it? You mentioned getting your first rental property. I have a huge fear of loss. I don't like doing investments where I lose. And if the market's incredibly hot today and it might pull back, but we have interest rates that could work against us. You know, you identified, hey, you go find a property that's hot, an area, you find a house that you like, and you just pull the trigger. You just do it. I mean,
But you do your research first. You know what it's going to rent for. I mean, you can do the math before you make the offer, and you should. You should say, look, if I make this offer, what will the results be? What will my cash flow be? How long will I have to hold this property to have a 95% chance of a profit? And the answer could be 5 or 10 years. You know, you may have to hold on to it for a while because prices could go down next year. But if you look at the people that bought at the top of the last market, you know, and paid way too much. Everybody thought they paid way too much. And prices in my town dropped in half. The people that held on to those houses have a big profit today. So it's a timing issue. You know, so if you have enough time, if you're willing to hold something for 5 or 10 years, your risk drops way, way down as long as you can make your payments. And so if you have a fixed interest rate loan, your payments are stable. And if you know what the rents are, rents will probably go up over the next 5 or 10 years. You'll have more and more cash flow as time goes on. So it takes a lot of risk out of it. You know, the most dangerous thing I do is driving a car. If you compare investing in real estate to driving a car, real estate is so much safer. You can't die, you know. The worst thing that happens is you have some kind of bad financial problem, which you can overcome. You know, have a friend. But you've got a lot of friends in the business. Just even if you paid too much. One of my favorite students, a guy named Jimmy Napier, he was from Chipley, Florida. And Jimmy's an old country boy, but he used to stand up. I got him to teach classes. So he'd stand up in front of his classes and he said, you know, I paid too much for every property I've ever bought and they made me rich.
That's awesome.
So it's not the price so much. I mean, it certainly has something to do with financing. And I, you know, if you've read my book, you've heard me speak, stay away from short-term loans, stay away from variable rate loans, stay away from payments that can get you in trouble. But if the payments won't get you in trouble, and you can manage the house well, you know, you'll keep it full. And even if you lose $100 a month or $200 a month for a couple of years, but you know, that's not a big deal if you're tying up a $300,000 or $400,000 asset. You know, to keep it in perspective. Think long term, don't think short term.
Well, I'm Captain Long Term. I just hate losing, right? And then that's a relationship piece. And so, and I hope people listening identify with my issues being a baby about it. And I'd say the other piece, and I don't know if I asked this last time you're on, John, and maybe this will be helpful for those listening, it'll be helpful to me, and then we'll wrap up the show, is I like things maintained very well. I have a hard time lending something to someone and it comes back destroyed or ruined.
Yeah,
how do I get over that? How do you solve that problem?
Well, you can't take business personal. You know, if you're in a car rental business and somebody got your car dirty, you just wash it. Or if they put a dent in it, you charge them to fix it. Same things with a house. You know, if I rent a house to somebody and they break something, I fix it and charge them for the repairs. There is, if you're in a rental business, there's ongoing maintenance that you just have to budget for. And I budget about 20% of my gross income for ongoing maintenance. That's paint, carpets, floor covering, windows, roofs, you know, all the stuff that's going to go wrong in that house over the years. But you know, once you have your head around that, and you know 20% is going to go to maintenance, you set that 20% aside if you want to make yourself more comfortable. And then when you have to put a hot water heater in, you've got the cash. It's not a big deal. If you have to put a roof on, you may have to dig deep for the roof, but you'll get the money back over time. You know, because it's hard to save up that much money. So if those are your issues, buy a house that's in pretty good shape. I don't buy houses that need to be fixed up. I buy houses that have either been totally rehabbed or new or that are in really good shape, because then I know my maintenance costs will be low for the next 5 or 10 years. And that 20% can accumulate. So when I need a roof or windows or whatever I need, I'll have the money for it.
From a maintenance perspective, and then if you have a tenant that damages it, well, you have the money there too because they paid for it to fix it.
Yeah, you can charge a big security deposit. Find out what the biggest deposit you can charge in your state is and charge it. I get the biggest deposits in my town.
Well, you got your work. I would love to have you come back on again. Thank you, John. And we will put in the show notes the Zoom that's coming up with you Fortunato. And those who don't know Peter Fortunato, John's stories are great. Peter Fortunato's stories are great. And he always hits my funny button every time. I love his humor and how he approaches things. And his appreciation, well, his dislike for taxes. And I think we all resonate with that one. And so it's a great workshop that you guys put on. Thank you so much for coming on. I'm going to have show notes of your book as well. And Tammy, you want to wrap it up for today's show?
Please, John, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like what you were just saying is a lot of people, I think, make the mistake of thinking that money is risk management. But if I'm correct, you would say that knowledge is risk management.
Well, knowledge certainly takes the risk out of it. The more you know about something, and some people go overboard on this and they try to learn everything. You can't learn everything. You can't take the risk out of anything. You wouldn't drive a car if you were totally risk averse. So we take risk every day. You know, if you have children, you're taking risk. You get married, you're taking risk. There's a lot of risk in life, and you just have to put it in perspective. But financial risk is probably really low on the totem pole when you think about how these other risks really affect your life.
Excellent. And I feel like Ken would say the same thing in terms of the financial world. And so I think you guys are a great match. And John, I'm excited for everyone to be able to attend your event coming up. Just a great way to get some knowledge and be able to take steps forward. Thanks a lot for sharing your wisdom with us.
Thanks, Tammy. Thanks, Ken.
Well, thank you, John. Thank you, Tammy. Thank you to all the listeners of the show. And I look forward to next week's episode. So thank you. I'll see you soon.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. The content is intended for United States audiences only. Opinions expressed are as of the date of this publication, and such opinions are subject to change. Green Financial and Insurance Services Limited, Green, is not responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other claimed losses resulting from or related to the content presented. Green makes no representation as to the completeness or accuracy of the information presented. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. Forecasts are not a reliable indicator of future results. Investors should be aware of the risks associated with investing. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of capital. Investors should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile. Consult with a qualified financial advisor as necessary before making any investment decisions. Thank you for listening to the Engineer of Finance podcast with Ken Green.